Good evening, folks. We are going to get rolling, and let's start where we need to start. Heavenly Father, we're thankful to have the privilege of gathering tonight to talk about marriage, to talk about physical intimacy in marriage. Lord, this is a gift, and I mean that in two ways, Lord, that us being able to do this tonight is a gift, and the gift of physical intimacy is a gift from you. And I pray that you would be honored tonight, that we would have an appropriate sense of holiness in this conversation, and that we would leave with hearts that are very grateful for the way that you have designed us and the way that you've blessed us. And I ask this, Father, for the sake of the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen. All right, so we are talking about sex tonight. If you needed that explained to you in the Sunday services when we've said that we're going to be talking about the physical aspect of marriage, that's what we're talking about. I assume that was probably clear to most of us, but if not, well, there you go. When I do pre-marriage counseling, which these sessions are largely based off of that material, tonight we're going to be talking about a number of things that don't tend to get to in just a shorter pre-marriage session. This is one of my favorite sessions, and not for the reasons that you would think. It's not just that it's fun to talk about this. Rather, I enjoy seeing the awkwardness get drained out of the room in the first 5 minutes. Because when people come for this session, usually when we do pre-marriage counseling, this is the last session, and surprise, surprise, people are usually pretty weirded out to talk to their pastor about sex. And I really enjoy, within the first 3-4 minutes, just watching the awkwardness kind of leave as they realize, oh, this is just this kind of conversation. Okay, this isn't all that bad. And to have it really not be all that awkward at all. And there's a lot to say about that, why that's the case. And that's actually kind of where we're going to start. We're going to start talking about two stories about sex. And what I don't mean there is personal story. I mean large narratives about sex that are told in our world. And we're going to start just with the general broad wide paintbrush way of asking, what is the world's story on sex? What are we told about sex in the world today? As we really think about asking two specific questions today, what is sex and what is it for? Remember, we started off with marriage. What is marriage and what is it for? It's basically what we're doing tonight with sex. What is it and what is it for? Or what is it for? And when we look to the world to see what sort of answers the world gives, we could go way back to kind of find the roots of the story that our culture tells us today. The really dominant notes of the world's story have their roots, like I said, a way back, but really came to the forefront in the 1960s with the sexual revolution. Now, if you've read, what's his face? The guy that wrote The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, Carl Truman. If you've read his book, or he wrote a shorter version of that, you'll understand that the sexual revolution didn't come out of nowhere. It wasn't just like they invented the pill and all of a sudden people could have consequence-free sex and boom, we had the sexual revolution. Nevertheless, the sexual revolution was still very significant as sort of the final step in a progression that our society had been moving towards. So since the time of the 1960s, since the sexual revolution, what is the story that our world tells us? Let's just start with the question, what is sex? And of course, I'm not talking the mechanics of it, but what I mean is, what is it about? What's going on really when two people come together physically? And what does our world tell us? Okay. It's an experience for pleasure. That's in some cases, that's it. It's a basic biological need. That's just what people need. It's what people do. It's what you should assume people will do. Not doing it is harmful psychologically. That would come from Freud, the idea of repressed sexual desires. I mean, Freud saw sexual desires as the root of basically everything, which maybe said more about him than the rest of us. But basic biological need, it's dangerous to repress it or to say no to it. Other ideas. What, and when I say what's the world tell us, I don't mean like when we're explicitly being taught. The world is catechizing us about sex every time we turn on the radio, or, well, we don't listen to the radio anymore, right? Every time we pop on Spotify, or every time we go to a movie theater, or every time we see a billboard, we're being catechized. We're being trained in regards to thinking about sex. What are some other messages that the world tells us about sex?
It's no big deal. It's a commodity. Exchangeable.
Get over it, Christians. Like, what are you so uptight about? Absolutely.
Why would God care what I do with my body?
Pierre Trudeau famously said something to the effect that the government has no business in Canadians' bedrooms, and we've kind of applied that to God as well, right? What I do with my body as a consenting adult with another consenting adult is between us, and if we want to do it, then that's good.
Yeah, the consent is the bar to entry.
Yeah. Sex is what you do with someone as a natural progression when you pair off. Think of the story that's told in movies, that a couple meets and has chemistry and a connection, and if the movie's not trying to go for a PG rating, what does the couple do next? They hop in bed together. Whether that act is portrayed or not, it's implied. That's the message that is so pumped at us from the world, and I mean like sewage, just dumped on us from all sides, that sex is the natural thing that two people do when they pair off. And I'm not even going to say when they're in love with each other, because I mean, what's love got to do with it? As was that Tina Turner or Janet Jackson famously said? And frankly, that message has gone a long way. But you think of hookup culture, you know, people go to the bar, they find someone, there's chemistry, and they shack up. That's just what you do as the natural progression in a relationship. That's how you express love and affection in a relationship. So if you've coupled off with someone, that's just what you do. And so the big debate is, you know, are you being a sleazy guy to invite her home on your third date? And that used to be the big question, and now it's like, how quaint to get to a third, to even date, let alone get to a third date without ending up in one of your beds. That's how you express love. That's how you express affection. That's the basic stuff. That's what's going on in a relationship. Like, you essentially could boil down modern quote unquote dating to, this is the person that I'm regularly having sex with. And we can see that. Pick an artist, pick a pop star, and listen to 10 of their songs, and just listen to how they talk about sex and how they talk about relationships, and you'll see that they're basically the same thing, and their relationship is just completely inherently sexual. That's just what it is. What we see is that sex should be fun, spontaneous, passionate. Good sex equals a good relationship, just in the way that sex equals relationship. What we see portrayed in movies is that good sex, just happens, and it's a very natural thing to have kind of spontaneous, passionate, even wild encounters that just happen very naturally. Sex is important to a happy life. If you're not having sex regularly, you're not having a fulfilled life. Unless you're asexual, which is which is a whole categorization that people assume you must be if you're not regularly having sex. Here's another one, and I'll maybe pause here in a moment because maybe I'm stirring some recollections for some of you that you want to jump in here. But one of the other messages in our world is that you have the right to an incredible sex life. Everybody has the right to this. You have the right to incredibly fulfilling sex. And you can have that with enough knowledge and with the right partner. And so combined with this is this idea of sexual chemistry or sexual compatibility, that there are certain people that you will have it with and certain people that you won't have it with. And so part of the purpose of dating and hooking up and moving around is to try to find that person with whom you have really good sexual chemistry, and with the right person and with enough knowledge, you can have, you can achieve the right that you have to continuously to ongoing experiences that are fulfilling, physically fulfilling. Sex need not have consequences, emotional consequences, physical consequences. There is no coincidence that the sexual revolution corresponded with the availability of birth control and very, very shortly the legalization of abortion. We would not have had the sexual revolution without those things. And we could add to that a third thing, which is the ascendancy of second wave feminism. All of those went together because the argument of feminists had been that for years, men had been able to enjoy consequence-free sex whenever they wanted to, because they could just leave the woman to deal. The woman had to deal with all the consequences, and by all the consequences, I mean the baby, right? And what the sexual revolution provided? Well, there was the philosophical justification from feminism that women should be able to have this thing that men have, or that it wasn't fair for just men to have it, or however you'd frame it. And then between the pill on a regular basis and abortion for when you weren't using the pill or when it didn't work, finally women could achieve that. And so that's what you saw in the 60s, is this huge emergence we could say the normalization of feminine promiscuity. But before that point, women could not be as promiscuous as it was believed men could be because they would bear the consequences of that. So you have this emergence of female promiscuity, and that's why you have, let's pick on pop stars again because they're easy to pick on, but that's why you have, you know, someone like Taylor Swift in her 30s who slept with how many guys, sung about it for all of us to hear, has no children, no consequences, right? Instead of leaving a legacy to children that she's investing in, she's moping about the last guy that broke her heart in bed, right? That's the result of that. So children are a bother. You can get rid of however you want to. There's no connection between sex and children. Anything else that you guys want to jump in here with to finish that sentence? By the way, with this big divide between, I'm going to get dizzy tonight, like just like going like this. So if I fall down, just lay me flat on the ground, and I'll come to. We got a couple more. Sex is inevitable. Teenagers are just going to do it. They just are. It's just inevitable. So parents should try to help them do it safely and have some wisdom in it, but it's just inevitable. Teenage sex in particular. So let's keep talking about the modern story, particularly the 1960s and the sexual revolution. We've talked about a few of these themes coming together, or these social tidal waves of contraception, legalization of abortion, which was really fueled by feminism and the the belief that women have a right to consequence-free sex. That's why, and we'll come back to this, that's why abortion is defended so violently by people, and I use the word violently on purpose. Everybody knows that a fetus is a baby. I mean, big surprise here. That's not the issue. The issue is that women have a right to consequence-free sex with whomever they want, whenever they want it, and they'll kill for it, literally. That's what's going on with abortion. Some of the other factors that gave rise to this was the rise of sexology. So going back a little bit earlier, like in the 1950s, you had the rise of guys like Kinsey, sexologist, Masters and Johnson, and these were scientists who, A, had some major issues, but B, were studying sex from a medical scientific perspective for the very first time, and were publishing out in public information about the sex lives of North America, well, Americans in particular. I forget who said it, but someone made this really wise comment, is that for most of human history, sex has had a very careful place in history and in societies where what you don't know about it is as important as what you do know. Like in other words, it was shrouded in taboo, and you knew that other people were doing it because you knew where babies came from, but there was a lot that you didn't know about what was going on. There'd be rumors about the ladies on the red light district and your kind of strange neighbor and the people he takes home. But what Kinsey and in particular and Masters and Johnson and people like that did was they all of a sudden brought out into the open the weird sexual proclivities of everybody in America and sought to normalize it all. We're all kinky in some way, they argued. We've all got these strange desires, and all of that's normal. And it made public for the first time what had been private for essentially the whole history of the world with a few examples. How many of you, like when I talk about Kinsey, how many of you know who I'm talking about? Okay, so it's interesting, a guy that's changed our world in so many ways that we might not even know who he is, but published some significant books on male and female sexuality in the years after the First World War that really changed public conversation about this. And what guys like him and Masters and Johnson studied was, like I said, sex from a medical perspective. Sexual technique became a concept that there were ways that you could, particularly for women, enhance sexual pleasure to achieve these sexual experiences that everybody deserved, because that's what it was about. That's what sex became about. So we get to today, where these ideas are just in the water. This is just what our world believes. Sex is what you do. It's inevitable. You're going to start doing it when you're a teenager. You're going to do it with every person you couple off with. You deserve it. It's a normal, basic biological need, etc., etc., etc. Here's why we're talking about this, is that my concern is that many, many Christians are essentially syncretistic when it comes to the issue of sex. Here's what I mean. We essentially have bought into the world's idea of sex. We've swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. And I mean, it's like a trap and it's stuck in our throat like a fishing lure. We've swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. And to this basic worldview, we've essentially added a couple of things from the Bible. That's what syncretism is, where you essentially have a fundamentally pagan or unbelieving worldview, and you add a little bit of the Bible to it, and so you end up with this mix of both. I believe that many, and I would hate to say most, but many Christians have done this, that they have allowed the world with its onslaught of movies and songs and ads and messaging and stories to brainwash us, convince us of this basic narrative, and yet we add a few little things. So for unmarried Christians, we essentially buy into the idea that it is natural to just have sex with someone that you love. Now, God prohibits it, which is why we sort of, if we have decided to save sex till we're married, we wear it like a badge of honor, like we're doing this really rare thing. Like, I'm not doing that. Like, the way that people will talk about being a vegan, you know, like, well, I don't eat meat. As if it's this high, noble thing to achieve to. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that, I'm not necessarily saying that it isn't, but just hear what I'm saying. Often the way we talk about saving sex for marriage shows that we essentially have bought the world's basic view that having sex before you're married is just what you do. That's just the normal thing. And God, you know, asks us to do this really unnatural thing. Saving sex before you're married is like waking up at 5 a.m., you know? It's like this really niche thing that you do that's good for you, but, you know, it's not really the most natural thing. To that, we have this idea that the thing that God has told us to save for marriage is sexual intercourse, but that having sexual experiences with someone that you're not married to is totally fine and, in fact, totally natural. And I've taught on this topic enough to feel the wrath of many young Christians when they hear me try to explain to them from the Bible that God never said save sexual intercourse for marriage. He said save sexual intimacy for marriage. And that's a pretty hard, it's a challenging message for people to hear, because making out is fun, and that's why you do it. Making out is a sexual activity. That's why you do it. And people are challenged by that. And so that's often not really the view. The view is, well, we can kind of engage in all kinds of sexual activities, but as long as we save that final thing for marriage, then, you know, then we're kind of doing what God wants us to do. Getting married to someone that you love so that you can have sex with them becomes a natural way to think about things for young unmarried Christians. I'm in love with them. I want to have sex with them. God says not to have sex till you're married, so we're going to get married so we can have sex. That becomes a kind of a pretty natural way of thinking about things. And we're going to talk about how, we're going to talk about the damaging effects of that. And you might think, well, isn't that what 1 Corinthians 6 or 1 Corinthians 7 says? And it isn't, and we'll get to that tonight. Marriage is the way that you get at those amazing sexual experiences that everybody's been talking about. That's a very common view. So the world has all this talk about you deserve this amazing, fulfilling, mind-blowing, the stuff that goes on the front cover of Cosmopolitan sexual experiences, and Christians say, yeah, and getting married is how you do that. So that's one of the very common messages by, like, you know, those abstinence teams that show up at the youth groups to show you how cool it is to wait till you're married. It's like, you're going to have the best sex if you wait till you're married. And so marriage becomes the ticket to get at what the world is selling us. Waiting until marriage becomes the ticket to get at this basic sexual message that the world is giving us. Although, let's be honest, lots of Christians today barely believe this. I remember being so stunned, and I wouldn't be stunned anymore. I worked at a Christian school, and I remember being in the staff room with parents of teenagers and was just so grieved to hear these parents of teenagers talking about how their kids had started to date and were out late at night and coming home late and just basically shrugging their shoulders and being like, well, what can we do? And, you know, the idea was they were just assuming that their teenage Christian kids were sleeping around because that's just what you do. And then people around the staff room started to be like, well, I mean, me and my spouse didn't wait till we were married and we're doing okay. And other people, yeah, I mean, neither did we and we're doing okay. Now, statistically, 8 out of 10 Christian young people are not virgins when they're married. And I think one of the things I hope that we can get to tonight, and if I don't get there in my notes, please remind me about it, is how to approach marriage as someone who does have a sexual history and a sexual past. But what I'm talking about here, not trying to talk about that as much as the way in which many Christians have essentially we've essentially waved the white flag on this. We've surrendered to the culture. Let's just assume that's just what you're going to do. And what that's coincided with is a real reaction against purity culture. Anyone followed that conversation on the internet in the last few years? So purity culture is like the 1990s thing that tried to make it look like, tried to make it sound like saving sex for marriage was the coolest thing to do. You know, I'm sure that you couldn't write a history of purity culture without writing about DC Talk and their song, I Don't Want It. How many of you know that? Doug, you know what I'm talking about, right? Anyone else? Okay, so you guys got to go back. 1992, and DC Talk does this song. And I remember, so we would listen to DC Talk a lot. And whenever we would get to that song, my mom would go over and press fast forward on the cassette player. I'm dating myself here, okay? I'm 40 next week, so I'm allowed to do that. And then I remember finally the day when mom sat us down. She's like, okay, kids, you're allowed to listen to this song now, and I'm going to tell you what it's about. It's about waiting until you're married to have sex. Now, by that point, I think we knew where babies came from, or generally. Don't remember the exact order, but all like, man, I felt cool bopping around to DC Talk. I don't want it. I'm not going to go on for you now, but anyways, I have all the raps memorized. Anyways, purity culture. So we did, that was the big thing with like the purity pledges. I promise to, you know, save myself for marriage. You'd write it on a pledge and you'd have your card and you'd carry it out in your back pocket where, you know, you're sure to check the next time you're in the back seat with your boyfriend or girlfriend, like, you know, that's what you do is, oh, look, I signed a pledge. I guess I'm not supposed to do this, you know? It's incredibly, incredibly naive. So those were my youth group days, right? The height of kind of the whole purity movement, and you had Josh Harris come out with I Kiss Dating Goodbye, and really pushing this idea about saving everything for marriage. And what Josh Harris really popularized was this idea that I've kind of picked on already, is that's the way to have the best sex, is by saving it till marriage. And then you get at that mind-blowing sex that everyone's talking about. Well, a lot of people found out that promise didn't really come true for them. They got married and they kind of didn't have the best sexual experiences and the best sex lives that they had been promised. And for numbers of other reasons, in the last number of years, there's been this real rejection against purity culture. It's interesting, Josh Harris himself bought into it, did this whole documentary of him basically apologizing to people for making them so uptight about sex and ruining their sex lives, and that was pretty key in him apostatizing from the faith entirely. This is one of the things that we don't often talk about, is that I've seen a huge connection between the whole deconstruction movement that's going on and sex. So we've heard about for a number of years now. I mean, maybe it's in the rearview mirror a little bit, but so many people in their 20s and 30s leaving the faith, apostatizing, and we often dress it up in these really intellectual clothes, like, oh, I have all these problems with the faith, and yet what we haven't really pointed to is something that I've just seen over and over again, is how many people are walking away from the faith because of sex. They want to have sex, and if they're not going to be allowed to have it within Christianity, then guess what? They surrender. And this comes from essentially buying into the world's view on sex. So it's pretty serious. So that's a lot for unmarried Christians, right? What happens when we buy into the world's story on sex and we insert biblical truth here and there? We end up with quite a mess. For married Christians, many married Christians have bought into the view of the sexologists that and the sex therapists that regular mutually fulfilling sex is what you deserve and what you need. And like we've said, marriage is how you get that. That's why one of the reasons you get married, so that you can enjoy that thing that the world's been telling you that you need and promising you. A husband's job in sex is to give his wife the mind-blowing experiences promised her by the cover of Cosmopolitan magazine that feminist sexologists have told her that she deserves. You open up any Christian sex book, and that's going to be one of the dominant themes there. And Christian sex books, Christian sex blogs, they've become a whole market. And what many of them are doing is simply somewhat sanitizing and recycled the fundamental wisdom of the world. So what's the problem with all of this? What's the problem with this syncretism? I mean, hopefully it's obvious. There's lots of problems with this. For one, it doesn't work. People mess around before marriage. They have awkward honeymoons that don't match their expectations. They struggle with sex and marriage, and they blame purity culture. And you'd be surprised, I think we'd be surprised how much sex is to blame, or at least is a factor in a lot of the divorces that we see among Christians. You know, no one's going to come out and say publicly that that's what's going on. But when you read some of the stuff that people publish when they're behind a screen, I think we'd be surprised. Or we see many times Christians embracing feminist understandings that sex is primarily about sexual fulfillment and having amazing experiences. Again, we've talked about that's the husband's job to provide that for her, and we baptize that in biblical language. And I'm thinking here of, you know, people like Sheila Ray Gregoire, and that's become such a popular kind of way of thinking about that. Pursuing, and she's just one example of many authors who are kind of there to help Christians pursue quote-unquote great sex based on the wisdom of the world for the same reasons as the world. Basically, engaging in sex the way the world does, except it's okay because we've got a ring on our finger. That's the assumption, and I think we will see what is wrong with this even more as we walk through tonight, and we compare the world story to the better story that God tells us. And we're going to see the better story, and we're going to come to realize how much we miss out on when we buy into the world story. So let's talk about the better story. Let's talk about God's story. Let's talk about sex from His perspective. And anyone have a guess as to where we're going to turn in the Bible for the first? Or where we're going to turn in the Bible first? Just guess.
Song of Solomon.
Not Song of Solomon. Genesis chapter 2. We've touched on some of these themes already. This is not going to be brand new, hopefully. We want to review some of the things that we've talked about already in this series and kind of see how they bear on this topic. Genesis 2:24. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Leaving and cleaving. Hold fast to his wife. We reviewed this a few months ago, but let's talk about that. Holding fast is both speaking about a physical experience and a fill-in-the-blank experience. A physical experience and a...
emotional.
Well, it involves that.
Spiritual.
It involves that.
Covenantal
experience. 10 points to the pretty gal in the back row. For the video, that's my wife. So we saw how this is a covenantal we saw this as covenantal language in the book of Deuteronomy. I think it's 10:20, or if I got that wrong, it's 20:10, where the Lord says, you shall swear by my name, you shall hold fast to me. It's the same word, covenant faithfulness. And yet we saw how it can also imply a physical act. And we saw one other place in the Bible where these come together, in the book of Ruth, where Naomi is telling her daughters-in-law to go back. Orpah kisses her goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. And we saw how that language of clinging there is the same word, hold fast, which implies physically holding fast. And yet, as Ruth goes on to say, where you go, I go, where you stay, I stay, your God, my God, it also implies covenant faithfulness. And the Apostle Paul brings both of these together in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, which we're going to spend some time in 1 Corinthians 6 and 7 tonight. And Paul essentially brings together Genesis 2:24 and that Deuteronomy passage. I have 10:20 in my notes, but being dyslexic, I'm pretty sure it's 10:20. But if it's 20:10, forgive me. So he's talking about sexual immorality in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Verse 15, do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? So we've talked about this at our membership meetings, right? This idea, like the member means a part of the body, right? Like this is so good, guys. When we are joined to Christ, we become a part of his body. And that's not just a spiritual reality. We so often divide flesh and spirit. We're such good little Gnostics or dualists, right? Dividing flesh and spirit. No, Paul's saying, do you not know? In other words, you should know this. Your bodies are members of Christ. So Jesus has hands. They're your hands. He has feet. They're your feet. They're our feet. Like, our bodies are members of Christ. Jesus is Lord of our bodies. Shall I then take the members, the body parts of Christ, and make them members, body parts of a prostitute? Never. And he can hear already the objection. What are you talking about, Paul? Like, what? I'm not becoming a member with a prostitute. I'm just letting off some steam after a long day. That's kind of how it was viewed in Corinth. Prostitutes are everywhere. The word to Corinthianize meant to sleep with the prostitute. I mean, it was one of the most sexually immoral cities in the ancient world, which is saying a lot. And that's just what she did. And it was just, like, this was a very common view, is that a man would have a wife for raising children and prostitutes for sexual fun. That's kind of how it went. You didn't view your wife as the primary person to have sexual experiences with. You just had kids with her, and if you needed to let off steam, that was with the prostitutes. So you can almost hear them saying, like, well, what are you talking about? Becoming members of her? What's going on? So then he asks them another question, verse 16. Or do you not know that he who is joined holds fast? Okay, in Greek, coming from the Greek translation of the Old Testament, this is the word from Genesis 2:24, aha, and Deuteronomy 10:20. I had it right. He who is joined, he who holds fast to a prostitute, becomes one body with her. Do you hear the language from Genesis 2:24 there? That by holding fast to a prostitute, by cleaving unto her, so here we clearly see that holding fast is talking about physical union. The man shall leave his father and mother, hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Well, that can happen when you hold fast or cleave unto a prostitute. You become one body with her. And he's saying that there's so clearly we can understand sexual intercourse is the most intimate that two bodies can be. And yet more than just the physical experience, there is a greater union that goes on there. So someone used the word emotional earlier. That's definitely part of it. That's why, like, I'm old enough to remember when the phrase friends with benefits first started getting used. And essentially, before that, people believed in casual sex. You could kind of just have casual sex with different people. But casual sex still implied a little bit of more relational regularity and intimacy than most people were comfortable with. So they kind of had this idea that developed of friends with benefits, where you would just have sex with your friends, and it didn't imply any romance. That's kind of part of the thing there. So casual sex still implied some romance, and, you know, it was like the guy that I worked for in the construction site who had a list of, you know, 12 or so women that on any given weekend he would call one of them up, and he would take them out for dinner and treat them nice and take them home to bed, and it was casual sex, but it still kind of had this sense of romance, and friends with benefits just trashes that and just says, you're just friends, it's just some guy, but you're like, well, let's just decide that it's okay for us to have sex together. That's the quote-unquote benefit. The problem with it is that it didn't work, because why? What ends up happening when you have sex with someone? Everyone started falling in love with these people that they were having sex with. Because of course, right? So yes, there is an emotional union that goes on. Someone else used the word spiritual. I'm not going to comment on that too much, except to say that there does seem to be something going on here in terms of some kind of a spiritual union. What exactly that means, what it looks like. C.S. Lewis talked about a spiritual union that happens, that when it breaks, that's part of why when you sleep with someone and you break up with them, it's so devastating, because you have really been joined together on multiple levels. For as it is written, the two will become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord, verse 17, he who holds fast to the Lord, so same word, hold fast to a prostitute, physical union, hold fast to the Lord, covenantal union, becomes one spirit with him. And so this is now this idea that you are a body part of Christ, and how can a body part of Christ become body parts with a prostitute? It just doesn't work. Flee from sexual immorality. So what we see here is that sex is, or at least is supposed to be, a physical act that corresponds to a covenantal reality. The two shall become one flesh. And we've said, is that physical or is that covenantal? The answer is yes. It's this beautiful case of Hebrew double entendre. A couple, when they are married, becomes covenantally one. And in sex, they reenact that reality on a physical level. So as we ask the question, fundamentally, what is sex? My answer from Genesis 2:24, from 1 Corinthians 6, is that sex is a physical reenactment of the covenant union. And we could take just put that in different language. Sex is the covenant sign of marriage. Why do I say covenant sign? Anyone want to take a stab at biblical covenant theology to ask why I would use the phrase covenant sign?
Entry to the covenant? Let's you all those things.
A sign associated with them?
A physical sign.
The sign doesn't effectuate the covenant, but in some senses it kind of does, right?
It does.
All covenant signs.
So let's think about covenant signs. There's some question about what's the covenant sign of the initial creation covenant with Adam and Eve. But certainly with Noah and the covenant that God reestablishes with creation with Noah was the covenant sign. It's a physical reality, right? And what does the rainbow signify? What's it do? What's the rainbow do? What does God say the rainbow does?
Reminds him of what you're thinking.
All right. Every time I see it, I'm going to be reminded of the covenant that I made. So there you've got this physical sign that is a reminder. Okay, so if you're taking notes, this might be helpful to kind of write some of this down. The functions of the covenant sign. So reminder is a big one. Now, there's also some question, because God doesn't actually use the word rainbow, and I'm not actually even sure if there's a Hebrew word for rainbow. The word he uses is bow. It's the same word as like for a war bow. I've hung my bow in the sky. And so there are some who say that the sense is that God's describing himself as a warrior, and he's hung his bow up. And which way is it pointing? Not down, it's pointing up. So there's some symbolism there, is that God's saying, I've set aside the wrath that I had. I won't take my war bow down to flood the earth again. And in fact, the bow's pointed up at me. So I'm putting myself on the line here. Now, that's reading too much into it. I don't know. But at least we see their physical manifestation. It's connected to... So is there a connection between the physical manifestation and the reality of the flood? Okay, what caused the flood? At least in part. Rain. What causes rainbows? I mean, this is... If you need me to answer this for you, then I don't know if you should be here tonight, but rain. So there's a connection there in that when the experience that caused the flood happens, in other words, rain, not all the time, but very often we see this reminder that it's not going to keep going. So there's a connection and a reminder. Let's go to the covenant with Abraham and the covenant sign that God gives, which is painful. talking about circumcision. Have we considered, I know we would have talked about this when we were in this part of Genesis a couple years ago. Why circumcision? What's the connection between circumcision and the covenant with Abraham?
They didn't get a sign on there being cut off by the people of God.
Right. So there's the cutting off of the foreskin is symbolic of what would happen to you if you weren't circumcised. Either the foreskin gets cut off or you get cut off. Okay, so there's that.
Wasn't there some sort of association between circumcision and the means by which God would fulfill the covenant of Abraham?
That's huge. Okay, so guys, this is a grown-up discussion. God promised Abraham that he would have many, many children. There is a certain part of a man's anatomy that he uses to have children, and that anatomy is forever marked with the sign of the covenant. I mean, there's no question about the significance of that. That the very means by which that covenant is fulfilled is marked with the sign that you belong to God. Every child that a Jewish man Every child that a Jewish man had, he had with the reminder right there that this is a covenant baby. This baby is a fulfillment of the covenant promises. So we've got reminder again. We also have symbol. It's symbolizing. Now there's also the further symbolizing going on that gets picked up by the prophets, the language of circumcising your hearts. And there's the idea in which, and again, this is a grown-up conversation, but in which the foreskin comes to symbolize that which is sinful or unholy in us. And circumcision has this symbolization of putting off the body of flesh. That's language that Paul picks up, right? And that's Colossians 2, yeah. And it becomes this symbol of putting off that which is unclean to be set apart for God. Then we've got the covenant that God makes with Israel. And what is the covenant sign of that covenant, as God says in Exodus chapter 30? No, not 30. There's a 3 in there. Maybe it's 23. Oh, come on. I should have... written this down. Someone have a thing on their phone and want to search the word sign in Exodus. I mean, I could find it here, but I don't want to just leave you guys sitting there in silence. It's the Sabbath, by the way. 31. I was only off by one. And the Lord, this is 31, chapter 12. And the Lord said to Moses, you are to speak to the people of Israel and say, above all, you shall keep my Sabbaths, for this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I, the Lord, sanctify you. You shall keep the Sabbath because it is holy for you. Everyone who profanes it shall be put to death. Whoever does any work on it, that soul shall be cut off from among his people. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, holy to the Lord. Verse 17, it is a sign forever between me and the people of Israel that in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. So Israel rests 1 and 7, which in a culture where you couldn't just go get groceries from the store, you couldn't just order in pizza on Sunday, this is a big deal, right? And what did it symbolize? What was the function of the Sabbath? What do we read here? What's it a reminder of? Sorry? So that God made the world and God rested. So we're imitating him. We're being reminded that he's the creator, which is huge in a culture where you've got all these competing gods and you're being reminded, 1 and 7, God made all of this and he rested, so we're following him. And there's other passages that give additional significance to the Sabbath. I mean, even just here, you're to keep this sign that you may know that I, the Lord, sanctify you. I make you holy. I devote you to myself. So it's a constant reminder of being devoted to God. We talked about this morning, how many of the laws God gave Israel was to make them distinct from the nations around them and not working 1 day in 7. I mean, everyone else, it's like, hey, let's get some more work done. And all in Israel, everything stopped on Saturday. And that was a reminder, we belong to God. God sets us apart. So the Sabbath actually had a function. It actually did something. Not just reminding them of some things, but actually making them that much devoted to God on a regular basis. And further to that, the Sabbath was a constant opportunity to have faith in God that he's the one that's going to provide for you. It was a big deal to not work 1 and 7, and then going on from there to not work 1 and 7 years, like, which part of the reason why they never actually did that, because they didn't have the faith to believe that God actually would provide for them. So the Sabbath was a fresh opportunity to remember their covenant with God, to remember that he'd made the world, to experience his sanctifying grace, and to experience the rest that comes from knowing that he's your provider and he's going to take care of you. Remember the covenant blessings? If you trust me and keep my covenant, I'm going to bless you. So you can rest 1 and 7, because I'm going to make up for whatever that, you know, you're not going to need to work 7 days a week, because I'm going to take care of you. And so the Sabbath was a fresh chance to just enjoy this covenant grace with God, from God. New covenant. What is the sign of the new covenant? What's the entry sign of the new covenant?
Baptism.
It's baptism. What does baptism do? We should be expecting something, because we've seen some pretty consistent themes here. We've seen the theme of reminder. So what's baptism a reminder of? You've died with Christ. You've been raised with Christ. It's a reminder. We've seen the way that this language is used by different biblical authors. It's a reminder of God's great acts of salvation through judgment. So passing through the Red Sea, before that, passing through the waters of judgment at the flood and coming safely out the other side. Baptism reenacts and remembers those things. Let me save the reenactment for a moment. But baptism is a reminder of those things. It's a reminder of who you are. And then baptism actually reenacts. It reenacts your union with Christ. It's a physical reenactment. So just like we're spiritually united to Christ, in baptism you physically reenact through the water being buried and raised, and we could go on and say a few things more about that. But there's also a sense in which the Lord's Supper is an ongoing sign of the new covenant. It's the covenant meal, which is perhaps a slightly distinct from covenant sign, but it certainly does function in many of the same ways as an ongoing sign of the covenant, where again, what do? We remember. We remember what Christ did for us. We proclaim what he's promised to do. And we are reenacting his body broken for us, his blood shed for us. There's these sensual, and I don't mean that in the sexual sense, but just in involving our senses, this sensual, physical reenactment of what Christ has done. And I don't mean that, you know, I don't mean this in the Catholic sense in which Jesus is sacrificed for us again and again, but our senses are reminded in this sort of mini reenactment of his broken body and his shed blood. We're reminded of what he's done, and it's a fresh chance for us to receive and to taste his grace again. The Lord's Supper is a means of grace, not, again, in the Catholic way of thinking about it, but how can you not meditate on what Jesus has done for you, remember and proclaim what he's done, taste the gospel in that way, and not have a fresh encounter with God's grace? And so that's what's going on in that sign of the covenant. Why are we talking about all of this? Because we're talking about sex. I think that we can best understand sex as a sign of the covenant of marriage, in which many of these same things happen. So we're just going to quickly sum them up, then we're going to take a break for a few minutes. Sex is a physical reenactment of the covenant union. So what does it do? It reminds a couple that they are one. It's kind of hard to ignore the fact that you're one when you're coming together so intimately physically. It is a reminder of the covenant union. It is a proclamation of the covenant union. And it is a reenactment of the covenant union. Just like baptism and the Lord's Supper and the Sabbath is not just a reminder, but an actual experience. Remember, like the Sabbath is an actual fresh experience of God's covenant grace. The Lord's Supper is a fresh encounter with God's grace. So sex is designed to be an actual experience of covenantal union. You're not just saying we're covenantally united, you're actually experiencing it in a very profound and a very real way. Sex is a physical reenactment of the covenant union. And like we see in these other signs, sex is a reminder, it's a reenactment, and it is an occasion for celebration, for joy, and for covenant fellowship. As the people of Israel would rest on the Sabbath, it was to be a delight and a joy to them. We are to truly celebrate the Lord's Supper. Baptism is a joyful encounter. The rainbow is supposed to be a joyful thing. And so sex is a joyful reminder and reenactment of covenant fellowship and a fresh experience of that covenant fellowship. I think this is a way better story than the world can even hold a candle to. And we're going to talk a little bit more about why. But let's take a little break, stretch our legs, and it's 8:38, so like 5 minutes, 8:43, we'll come back here. Okay, so we're talking about sex as fundamentally being a covenantal experience. Is that a hand raised?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sex and other covenant symbols like are more substantial than a reminder, like effectuate the covenant? Because like I've heard you say before about people taking communion unbaptized, that's like wanting the perks of marriage without being married. And doing that, like I know what you mean as a Baptist, but in doing that you're very closely unifying the covenant symbol with the covenant and the commitment. So is there a way in which sex officiates the covenant in a way?
So I'm glad you touched on that, because I forgot to go there before. So we did talk about the fact that that these covenant signs are, in many cases, a fresh experience of the covenantal reality. So like resting on the Sabbath, you're actually experiencing God's covenantal reality, right? The Lord's Supper, you're experiencing covenantal grace as you do that. So it's not just a reminder, it's an actual experience. But let's talk, I'm glad you touched on that, Jordan. So the idea of a covenant sign also sealing the covenant. So this idea of it being a sign and a seal, that's really important. The sense is that the covenant is not formally ratified until the covenant sign has been applied. So this is a whole other piece. Can't believe I missed it, but I'm glad that Jordan's making sure that we don't. So if someone was born to Abrahamic parents, sons of Abraham, they didn't use the word Jew till later on, but if you're part of the house of Israel, you're not actually considered in the covenant until you've experienced the covenant sign, which is circumcision. That's why if you haven't been circumcised, you're cut off. You might have been rescued from Egypt, but if you didn't rest on the Sabbath, you'd be cut off from the people. The covenant sign actually was a seal. And to understand the word seal there, think about the idea of sealing the deal, like actually locking in that this has happened. And we kind of still practice that in many ways at a wedding ceremony with the ring. We say, with this ring, I thee wed. You put the ring on the finger. This, as a covenant sign, actually seals that covenant. It formalizes it. It seals the deal. And there's a sense in which sex does that for marriage, which is why we will often politely talk about a couple consummating their relationship. At least in Catholic understanding, if a couple is married and does not have sex and they split up, it's not called a divorce. What's it called? An annulment. Because the sense is that they actually didn't have a full marriage. It wasn't a complete marriage without sexual union. So it's an annulment. You sort of just erase those vows that were made. But until there is union, sexual union, the marriage hasn't actually happened. And so that's what we should, or the marriage hasn't happened in its fullness. It hasn't been consummated. It's been inaugurated, but not consummated. Just like the kingdom of God, right? It was inaugurated at Christ's first return, consummated at the second return. And so when a couple pledges their vows to one another and we say that the two have become one, what God has joined together, let no man separate, there's a sense in which that's true, but there's actually a sense in which it's not yet true. So you see this already but not yet theology pop up. I've married many couples, and I know as I marry them that they're already one flesh, and yet they are not yet one flesh until that is actually consummated physically. And then at that point, then the marriage is sealed. So, excellent point. So, understanding sex as a covenant experience, as a covenant sign, what does this help us see? Well, it helps us see a number of things. It helps us understand why sex is prohibited outside of marriage. All of a sudden, that goes from being kind of this like weird rule that God and the Puritans came up with to actually making the most sense in the world, because if sex is a covenant act, then the covenant act is for people who are in the covenant. Like, that's what it's for. It's not so much that you have sex in the context of romance and relationships and some really puritanical people save it for marriage. It's that sex is for marriage. It is for the covenant of marriage. And enjoying it beforehand is inappropriate. I've said this in other contexts, so some of you may have heard this, right? Talking about saving sex for marriage is like talking about saving your move-in date until after you get possession of your new house. We're not going to move in until after we get possession. It's like, well, of course not, because it's not yours yet. Like, you do that and you're going to go to jail. That's called that's called breaking and entering, right? No, like really, guys. And apply the same thought, guys. Sex before marriage is like breaking and entering. It's enjoying something that's not yours to enjoy. That's not what it's for. That's not what God gave it to you for. The idea in many of the passages in Scripture is that sex outside of marriage isn't so much prohibited as just out of the question. It's very interesting. If you're to read through the Bible from Genesis 1 up till the chapter that we just read this morning, so the timing here is pretty interesting. We did Genesis 33 in our service this morning. We've seen a lot of sexual perversion. Okay? We've seen Lot being raped by his daughters. We've seen homosexual gang rape. We've seen angels taking on physical form to have giant babies with the children of, or with the daughters of men. We've seen all kinds of crazy stuff. You know the first time in the story of the Bible that we see just quote-unquote good old-fashioned premarital sex? Boy sees girl, boy loves girl, boy has sex with girl. Where's the first time in the Bible that we see that?
Tamar?
No. Genesis 34, the passage that Austin's preaching on this Sunday. So, someone's in the kitchen with Dinah. You don't get the reference. Never mind. Anyways, Dinah, someone will get the reference. Maybe Amy got the reference, and she's laughing, and that does my heart good. So, Dinah is Jacob's daughter, and the son of Shechem falls in love with her and has sex with her. And what do the brothers of Dinah do? They slaughter the entire town. Because how dare he? Now, what they did was wrong. I think there'd be a lot less premarital sex if there were more brothers who were willing to do maybe not quite, I'm not advocating that level of violence, but a brother who would get in the face of another guy and say, no, you don't touch my sister like that or at all. What I'm saying is that the response to that act of a man treating an unmarried woman that way is so violent and so direct. And it says something about the way that the Bible thinks about this. So it helps us, so seeing sex as a covenant act helps us understand why it's reserved for marriage. That's because that's what it's for. Sex is the consummation of the marriage covenant. It helps us understand why sex is connected to children. Malachi 2:15, what was the one, did not the Lord make them one with a portion of his spirit in their union? So there's Genesis 2:24 language. And what was the one God seeking? Godly offspring. Malachi 2:15. There are some who interpret, and the two shall become one flesh, as the one flesh is actually talking about the baby that's produced when the two become one flesh. Now, that's not what Paul does with it in 1 Corinthians 6, but is there perhaps something to be said about that? That the two literally become one? I think there's no doubt some symbolism there. Throughout most of history, there has been a link between sex and offspring. And our modern world has done its best to sever that link. Now, we're going to talk a little bit later on about birth control, which I do not believe is a sin for couples to practice. But we can't ignore the fact that God designed the way in which babies would be born to be connected to this sign of the covenant. That's where you just get this whole beautiful structure of the nuclear family. And we know that children do the best when they're brought up in a family with a mom and a dad who are there to care for them. Like, the whole system has been designed by God so deliberately, so on purpose. And the fact that sex leads to children is not an accident. That's the way God set it up, because he designed children to be born into marriages, families. It also helps us understand why sex is pleasurable. Does God want sex to be pleasurable? Don't answer too quickly, because if so, you might be disagreeing with theological greats like Augustine, who thought that sexual pleasure was a result of the fall, along with mosquito bites and and things like that. Prior to the fall, he thought that sex would have been there, but would have just been a big nothing. Like, you'd be able to walk through the Garden of Eden and you'd see people eating fruit and people reproducing, and it wouldn't have been anything. It was just no pleasure, just what you do. And he believed that sexual pleasure, sexual passion was a result of the fall. Why is he wrong? Where do you go in the Bible to show that he's wrong? It's been brought up already tonight. Well, Genesis 2 doesn't actually say anything about pleasure.
Is now the correct time for Song of Solomon?
Now is the correct time for the Song of Solomon. Edge of his seat. Every question. Song of Solomon. Yeah, anyways, we're finally there. Song of Solomon. Okay. Who is the rabbi that said, you know, the scriptures, I mean, no, not a direct quote, but anyways, the scriptures is the holy place, and the Song of Solomon is the holy of holies. Song of Solomon is a really important book and deeply loved by generations of God's people. And it's not just about sex. I think we would be wrong to not see any reflection in there of the delight that God has in his people. And yet it is also about sex. And I think we can say it's about both, because of Ephesians chapter 5, right? The relationship between a man and a woman is a picture of the relationship between Christ and his people. So is the Song of Solomon about a relationship between a man and a woman, or the relationship between God and his people? Right? The answer is yes. Again, beautiful Hebrew double entendre. But the Song of Solomon is about sex, and it's full of wonderful descriptions of erotic delights, and that's not bad. What is God telling us by that experience? That he designed the sign of the marriage covenant to be the most pleasurable experience that a human can have. What's he telling us? Because he's telling us something. What is it?
Father gives good gifts, or what's that passage? He just wants to give a good gift to his children.
Yeah, he does want to give us good gifts, but why that gift in that way? Why is it the sign of the covenant of marriage that is the most intensely pleasurable experience physically that a human can experience?
Because it points to something that's greater?
Yes. But let's get there by starting a little bit closer to the actual sign. Okay. What's he telling us just about the marriage union and about what's he telling us about covenantal intimacy? That the sign of the covenant is such a wonderfully pleasurable experience. What's he telling us about covenant intimacy?
It's supposed to be pleasurable.
It's not a neutral thing. It's a wonderful thing. It's not just like, yeah, we're married, meh. No, it is a extremely joyful, wonderful experience. Relational intimacy is a wonderful thing. At the very least, that's what he's telling us. It is not a neutral thing to be close to someone. Relationship is joyful. And we see this in all kinds of relationships. Oh, how good and pleasant it is when brothers dwell together in unity. It is like the oil running down Aaron's beard, right? It's not just like, oh, there's some brothers dwelling in intimacy. Well, it's just what you do. And I was like, that's awesome. And what sex proclaims is how awesome it is to be united in covenant faithfulness. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. That's what the pleasure of sex is communicating, that the inherent joyfulness of relationship, which does point us to something greater. It points us to the incredible joyfulness that we already do experience and will experience in covenant union with our Lord. There's not going to be any sex in heaven, and we're not going to miss it. Right? So think about that. As Jesus said, they will neither marry nor be given in marriage. but we'll be like the angels in heaven. And we're not going to be thinking, man, I really wish that I could go take a body again. You know, like, we're not going to be like Nick Cage in City of Angels, you know? You guys are too young to get that. Where he becomes a man and embraces mortality so that he can have sex for a night with Meg Ryan. And that's where the Goo Goo Dolls song about the big, what's it called? Anyways, you guys are too young. I'm, you guys get it though, right? No, okay. Tina gets it. This is huge, you know, 1996, whatever. But that's, so, there, I mean, there's our world's message that and it's there in the Goo Goo Doll song, right? I would give up forever to be with you for one night, right? Iris, yeah. I would, and that comes from a movie where an angel, that was a theme song in City of Angels, where an angel gives up his immortality, embraces mortality to have a passionate night with a woman who gets killed in a car accident right away. And the whole message of the movie is that it was worth it for that one night of passion, okay? There's a word for that, and the word is like insane. It's literally beyond insane that he would give up the presence of God, which, I mean, of course, it's just stupid. But we are not, I remember being in youth group, we were doing these Bible studies, and one of the questions we were asked is, if you knew Jesus was coming back next year, what would you do? And I remember one of the girls like, well, I'd want to get married because I kind of want to have sex. I don't know about you guys. And I just remember saying, I was only 16 or whatever. I'm like, I don't think we're going to be missing that in heaven. Like, we're not going to be with Jesus and thinking it's great being here and all, but would have been really, no. So whatever pleasures we experience in sex, they are a pale reflection of the greater and surpassing pleasures that we will experience in the presence of God forever. Heaven is better by far, said the Apostle Paul. So way better than marriage, way better than whatever passionate encounters you can have. And the best sex is a pointer to the better experiences of relationship that we will have in heaven, which is a pointer to the boundless, exuberant, eternal, overflowing, exploding joy that the Trinity has been experiencing with one another for all time. Right? Because that's going to be the joy of heaven, is that Jesus is inviting us into the fellowship of the Trinity. As he says in John 17, that the love with which you have loved me may be in them. And so the idea is that we are going to be enabled to love Jesus with the eternal, overwhelming love of the Father himself. And if we could experience that, guys, we taste it in little bits here and there, but if you could experience that in your body right now, you would die. You would explode. We can't contain it. That's why we need to be transformed. That's why we need to have new resurrection bodies. And the joy that we will experience just in relationship with Jesus forever in heaven is going to make the best sexual experiences look like pale, thin little shadows next to the reality. So yes, it does point away from itself to something even bigger. Now, does all of this discount the fact that there is some basic biology to sex, that there is a biological drive, that men in particular with a higher, with their higher sex drive, driven by testosterone, have just a biological push towards sexual intimacy with a woman? Does, and not to say that women don't experience it, they just experience, the average woman experiences it far less often than the pop songs would suggest to us. But does everything we're seeing here about sex as this covenant sign and this beautiful pointer towards something else, does that kind of get undermined by the fact that there is just basic biology to sex, a basic physical biological drive that God's given us? Where else in the Bible might we see a case where a basic biological drive is used by God to bring people together in fellowship on a regular basis?
Uh, meals?
What'd you say?
The Lord's table.
Okay. I would say yes to that, except they were specifically told if they were hungry to eat at home, but you're on to something. Jordan's. I mean, same kind of thing. Jordan's, I think, a little bit more we're just eating together. Okay. Eating together, eating a meal together is more of an intimate experience than we would think. See, this is one of the things that we've lost in our modern world where it just is just fast food, shove it down, satisfy the biological drive. Particularly in the ancient world, a meal together was an act of intimacy. That's why covenants, when they were formed, you would seal it by eating together. Why David would talk about, like, they ate with me and now they've betrayed me, and that was so painful because to eat with someone was an act of intimacy. That's why it was so awful what Judas did, that he broke bread with Jesus and then went out to betray him. That's why the church in Corinth was told to not even eat with someone who professed Jesus and yet persisted in unrepentant sin. That's why it was so scandalous when Jesus sat down to eat meals with tax collectors, right? To sit down and eat a meal together, it's an act of intimacy and closeness and relationship, more so in the ancient world, and we've lost that in many ways, and perhaps we should work at recovering that. Although even modern science and just sociologists and so on would tell us that it's really important for families to eat together. And that's why they recommend, like, slow down your eating. Don't just sit down at the table, scarf through your food, and rush off to the next event. And this, I mean, I hope I'm feeling some conviction here about some of the ways that that meals have been happening in our home. And this is a helpful reminder here, is that for family to eat together is actually really key, and in many ways becomes like the glue that kind of holds that family together at a relational level. So we could ask the question, if all that's true in the Bible and in sociology, is eating together both a symbolic, significant relational experience or a basic biological drive? Well, the answer is yes. It's like one of those wonderful biblical trick questions. And so we see how the basic drive to need to eat, God has put in place when there are those structures in place, that we can then come together, and that biological drive pushes us towards relational intimacy. It's supper time, and all the hungry people come together and don't just satisfy a biological drive or a physical need, but actually experience some form of relational intimacy together. I think the same thing's going on with sex. There is a basic biological drive there, and that biological drive pushing us towards intimacy is very much the way that God has set things up. This understanding sex as a covenant act helps us understand from Ephesians 5 why a husband has a responsibility to care for his wife with whom he has become one flesh. It also helps us understand why the best and the most frequent sex is had by long-term committed couples. This is something that goes very much against what we would have suggested to us by the pop stars and the movies, that the best sex is not had by young couples falling into bed for the first time. The best and most frequent sex is being had by couples who have been married and who have been together just with each other for 20 years or more. Because what does that tell us? That tells us that, and we're going to come back to this in a bit, that basically sex is going to be as good as your relationship is. Because sex is a picture of your covenant relationship. And the better your covenant relationship is, the better that sex is going to be. Anyone want to jump in with a question or a comment here before we kind of shift into this next section here where we talk a little bit about expectations for those who are not married? But before we do that, anyone want to jump in? Okay. What does this picture, this story, this biblical vision of sex tell those who are not married? I think it says a thing or two about the experience of honeymoon disappointment. When I do pre-marriage counseling, I talk to people about this, and I ask them, how many times have you heard people talk about this? Christian couples who talked about how awkward or disappointing their honeymoons were. So how many of you here in this room have, and I don't mean this in a humorous way, I mean literally I've heard other people talk about this, that they had a difficult, challenging, awkward honeymoon. I mean, you're allowed to put up your hands. Okay, yeah. Do you think that people 80 years ago talked about how awkward their honeymoons were? We know they didn't, because that's why honeymoon has become a phrase for not awkward things, but wonderful things. You know, you're still in the honeymoon phase. The honeymoon is when everything's all wonderful. And that's part of why we struggle, because now it's like, well, this is actually kind of awkward, and that's not what I thought. I've heard stories, some personal, some like shared with me, and some have read secondhand or thirdhand of people, you know, 60, 80, maybe even 40 years ago, who their honeymoons were just these wonderful, almost magical experiences. And you talk to couples today, and you're more likely to be like, yeah, it wasn't as good as we thought. It's kind of awkward. It's kind of challenging, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think is going on there? Why do you think that is? What does the average 22-year-old have today that the average 22-year-old 60 years ago did not have? The internet. And with it, what? Expectations of what it's supposed to be like. Whether that's from porn or whether that's just from PG-13 movies, or whether that's from Taylor Swift songs, we have expectations about what sex is supposed to be like because of how sexualized our culture is. And our reality doesn't match those expectations. And so young married couples often experience disappointment. They don't recognize that amazing sexual experiences like you see on the movies don't just happen. Sex is way more complicated and awkward than you would think. I mean, what you see on the, and when I say you see on the movies, I don't want to normalize it. We shouldn't watch other people have sex. Can we just say that? It's not normal. It's not good. But I'm assuming that most of us have at some point or another, even if it's just a PG-13 movie, where the couple stares into each other's eyes, comes close, starts kissing, falls over, and the camera fades, and then the camera opens up the next day with them in bed together. Although, you know, it's likely that they just slept together. No, of course not, right? We know what happens. And what I'm pointing to there is the silliness of how many Christian couples who think that they can do all of that and not go too far. But even just the PG-13 version, where the camera fades and whatever, it communicates that these sexual experiences just happen, and that they're easy and seamless and wonderful and passionate. And sex is not actually like that. It's quite a bit more normal than that. And it's kind of like riding a bike, where after you've ridden a bike for a while, it's pretty natural and pretty normal, but learning how to ride a bike is not like that at all. And what Christian couples need to understand is that learning your honeymoon and the first season of your marriage is like learning how to ride a bike. I had the privilege of teaching all three of my kids how to ride bikes. When they came back from their first time where I let go, and they did this, did they come in the door and were like, oh, Mom, that was so awkward. I could barely stay upright for more than 5 seconds, and Dad had to grab the seat again, and I fell off, and it's just like, I just see those guys on the Tour de France just whipping around on their bikes, and I'm just I can barely do that. It's what's wrong with me, Mom? No. It's I rode without Dad holding on for like 5 seconds. They're thrilled. Okay, that was people 80 years ago because they didn't. They just didn't think anything other than that. That's what was normal. We've got this idea from unrealistic media that we're going to be Lance Armstrong, and when a couple gets married or when a couple starts, well, hopefully it's when they get married that they start having sex. It's not like Lance Armstrong. It's more like a 5-year-old who just had his training wheels taken off, and so we should unmarried people should have that experience. But here's where it's so important for us to remember what we've been talking about, because sex is not primarily about having amazing sexual experiences. It's about acting out your covenant union. That's so important, because it means that the quote-unquote disappointing physical experiences aren't actually disappointing, because you got to act out your covenant union. And sometimes it's going to be physically out of this world, and sometimes it's going to be pretty physically normal. I mean, this is what unmarried people need to hear, people who aren't sexually active. It's like, people who are sexually active, they have bad days. Like, sex is not this wonderful thing that elevates you into this heaven like we hear all the pop stars singing about. It's pretty normal in many ways, and it becomes a part of normal life. It rises and falls with your relationship. And the negative, or what we would think of the subpar physical experiences, are actually just different experiences where you've still experienced the core reality of reenacting your covenant union. We recognize that sexual compatibility isn't something that you discover. That's a lie that we get from our world, right? Sexual compatibility is something you build with your covenant partner over years of learning how to selflessly love one another. So for unmarried couples, one of the big lessons that I would give to an unmarried couple who's looking at marriage is as best as you can, erase your expectations and start from zero. And that's easy to say, it's a lot harder to do, but go into it expecting to be like a 5-year-old or a 4-year-old or whatever it is, on a bike with the training wheels taken off, and just enjoy the every little bit and know that it's not going to be like Lance Armstrong on the Tour de France, and that's normal. And that's not actually what it's about. Let's also talk to the unmarried about the importance of purity before the wedding. Something being bad and forbidden has a way of making it feel really fun, doesn't it? Remember the story of St. Augustine's pears, or St. Augustine's pears? I'll tell you my own story. Me and my friend in Karenport in the trailer park used to sneak into his neighbor's yard and eat her rhubarb. You know what rhubarb tastes like when you just pull it right out of the garden and take a bite? It ain't good. But why do we do it? Because it was bad. And the fact that it was bad, and the fact that we weren't supposed to be doing it, the fact that there was this tension of the should we, shouldn't we, added a sense of adrenaline to it that made it feel fun. That drives a lot of sex. It's like Proverbs 9:17 that talks about, like, stolen bread is sweet. The fact that you stole it makes it taste sweeter because it's the adrenaline of this is bad. Let's be totally honest here. In the short term, having sex with someone that you're not married to, that you're even not in a regular relationship to, like, in other words, that you're hooking up with or having an affair with or someone you're not sure if you should be having sex with, short term, that sexual encounter will feel more exciting and more fun than most of the sex that happens in marriage. It will, because it's bad. And the adrenaline of, I'm not sure we should be doing this, this is so bad, adds to the thrill. This is why we just got to understand that having the thrilling experiences isn't what it's all about. And we got to understand that long term, the opposite is true. Over 20 years, and I could point you to all kinds of physical or all kinds of actual testimony of people who have said this in the scientific long-term studies. Long-term, over 20 years or more, it's the couples who have been faithful to one person for 20 years who have the highest sexual satisfaction and the greatest sexual experiences and the most frequent sexual experiences. And report way greater satisfaction than the people who are still hooking up with other people after 20 years, chasing that elusive thing. Short term, though, it is the case where the adrenaline. So here's what's sad. And what I'm about to say may be too much for some of you, but one of the things that you hear about, and I've been hearing more about in Christian circles, is the idea of married couples role-playing with one another. So maybe this is too much for some of you, but it's basically where a married couple pretends that they are unmarried and then has sex in this sort of pretend phase. And you've got people saying all kinds of things about why it's Christians should never do that or why Christians should do that. Here's what I'm concerned about with that, as I've reflected on it a fair bit, is that I think you can make the argument, well, that you're not technically sinning because you know that you are married and whatever. But here's the thing. My concern is that what a couple is doing is trying to reignite a sexual spark by pretending that they're doing something bad. And it's the fact that it's bad that's reigniting the spark, as opposed to a couple just enjoying their intimacy, covenant intimacy with someone that they know really, really well.
The fact that they're renewing their covenant, or
exactly, exactly, it's buying into the world's, it's buying into the wisdom of the world, right? It's basically buying into the fact that sex with a stranger is funner than sex with a spouse. So let's pretend we're strangers. It's very alluring. I can see why Christian couples would do it and would justify it. But after much reflection, rather than is it sinful? Which I think you. There's different ways you can get at that answer, but I think is it a wise use of sex given the story that God tells in the Bible in regards to sex? And I think the answer would be no.
Romans 12 too, right? What is good, what is acceptable, what is perfect, God's will. How does that happen? Transformed by the renewing of your mind. You can't get around that if your mind is actually still that.
Okay. I think you're onto something there. Why are we talking about this? Well, here's why we're talking about this. For unmarried people, there is the simple fact, and thinking about unmarried Christians here, where the sexual tension can be so thick and you just want to have sex with them so bad, and so you think, well, we just need to get married so that we can do that. And a lot of Christian couples float to the altar in a haze of sexual tension, and then they get married and it all changes because suddenly it's not bad anymore. It's not forbidden anymore. There's no should we, shouldn't we. It's like, well, we can have sex kind of whenever we want. And that changes things. That really changes things. It takes away a lot of the tension that was there back when it was bad. And that's, I can think, there's faces in front of my mind's eye right now of couples who so obviously got married mainly for this reason, and they've got really sad, shallow marriages because sexual tension, just, it's not the same in marriage. Now, again, it doesn't mean that there's no joy. In fact, long term, there's more joy, but it's that long term trajectory you need to have. And what I'm not saying is that a couple who has gotten married for these reasons is consigned to a sad and shallow marriage. You're not stuck there. You can build a really rich, wonderful marriage. And let me say a word here for people who have sexual histories and sexual pasts can still enter marriage and allow, and I know I'm summing up a lot here, but allow God to redeem their past. There will be things that they need to work through. There will be scars, but you can rebuild and tell a new story with your sexuality over the long term. It's going to be a journey, and a journey not of days or of weeks or of months, but of years. But you can make that journey. But it is so, like, this is one of the reasons why purity before marriage is so important, because if you make your relationship all about sexual tension, marriage may just be quite a bit more disappointing than you think. But if you make your marriage about pursuing the Lord together and enjoying covenantal union together, then sex is going to be this wonderful thing that just keeps getting better and better and better. One more thing is that before marriage, a woman might be more ready to think that a guy really loves her when he just can't take his hands off of her. After marriage, it becomes a little bit more obvious that he just couldn't keep his hands off of her. And that trust can really be depleted. So unmarried men need to earn the trust of the woman that they're with if she's going to be his future wife by treating her with respect now, so that she knows that she's truly valued and isn't simply an object for his pleasure. For married couples, for married people, and unmarried people should listen in, it might take a while to get over the Hollywood expectations. Those expectations are built in, are like, they're ingrained in us from a really early age. It can be hard for married couples to get over the fact that sex is not going to be the spontaneous, passionate experiences you saw on the movies just with a ring on your finger. That's actually going to look different. It's going to feel different. Like we've talked about a few months ago, you're going to have to schedule it and book it together on your calendar with something that doesn't say sex, so that if other people look at your calendar, they'll think that, you know, like you'll say taxes or something like that. That was always the joke. That was always the joke in Full House, right? They're doing their taxes. That's the reality, and that can be disappointing to people. That can be really disappointing to people if they're expecting the pop star. But guys, here's the thing. Pop stars aren't having pop star sex. It's a fantasy. It's just a fantasy that everyone wants it because we worship sex, because that's the closest thing to heaven that we have in our culture. And so we worship it at the altar of it, just like every false religion throughout history, or many false religions have, with temple prostitutes and whatever. Sex has been a part of religion all the way back. And we need to know how much of a fantasy that is. Most women are not as interested in sex as often as the average pop star's songwriting portfolio would seem to suggest. Do you know how often, now this is average, there are some women who are different more than this, some women who are less than this, but do you know how often the average woman experiences spontaneous, unprompted desires for sex? It's like roughly 1 or 2 days out of the month when she's ovulating, which God set up as at time of peak fertility. That's, I mean, who sings pop songs about that? Oh, baby, I want you once or twice a month. Like... It just doesn't work that way, right? But that's actually biological reality. Now, many women, married women, find that it is not until they have begun to be sexually intimate in an encounter with their husbands that the desire is there. But if they wait for the desire to be there, it'll never happen. So that's this causes this assumption that it goes desire, then act, is what's behind so much tension in marriage, where so many women are saying, well, not tonight, honey, because I don't feel like it. Well, most women won't feel like it most of the month. That's just the reality. She's going to have to say yes, and before she feels like it. That's the way that God designed women's bodies to work in general. Married couples can take a while to get used to that. Can we learn anything from the world? Okay, so just so you know, we're at 9:30. I'm thinking that we actually have only about 10 minutes left, and then about 5 minutes talking about birth control and stuff like that. So about 15 minutes left. If anybody needs to leave, I'm not, go. Just feel free if you're here and you need to leave. But we are going to finish up this material here. Can we learn anything from the world? In particular, here, what I'm asking is, can married couples learn from sex therapists in the world who have studied sex from a purely physical aspect and have, you know, just like a massage therapist learning, teaching someone how to give a really good back massage can help people engage in sexual activity in a way that will increase the pleasurable experience. Can married couples learn from that and gain from that? What do you guys think the answer is? I would suggest the answer is yes, but as always, we need to be careful to filter carefully through the worldview filter what we are receiving. So here's part of why I would say the answer is yes, is that we don't see in the Bible a big use of the logic of guilt by association. We could talk about meat sacrifice to idols. The fact that this cow was first sacrificed in the worship of a pagan god doesn't mean you can't still enjoy it. Paul enjoyed many of the aspects of the Roman Empire, even though they were initially designed for pretty wrong reasons, or Caesar's roads and all of that. It was all for his glory, and yet we could still benefit from it. So as we see this pattern, we could point to other examples of that. It is generally true that a couple of generations ago, most men didn't know a thing about sex, didn't know how a woman's reproductive system works, which is a shame because a woman's reproductive system is one of the coolest things God has designed. And I don't mean that in a teenage boy way. I mean, like, objectively, it's just incredible. Like, from the moment a woman conceives, how it's this Rube Goldberg machine to prepare her body 9 months later to give birth. It's incredible. But it's generally true that a couple of generations ago, most men didn't know a thing about this. They didn't know how to please women sexually. I remember reading once statistically that a couple of generations ago, sex tended to last 7 minutes long on average and was focused on male satisfaction. So is it good that today we have access to information that helps Christian husbands know how to please their wives? Well, I think we would generally say that that's not a bad thing. But we need to be careful because often that information comes with the feminist assumption that having fulfilling experiences is what sex is primarily about. And we want to firmly say, no, that's not what it's primarily about. That is something that we can experience alongside of what it's mainly about, which is union and intimacy. And here's what's really interesting, and I think this comes from later on in my minutes, but many women find that what makes for the best sex is not technique, but emotional intimacy. It's a sense of safety and being able to be at peace, being protected and truly cherished by a man that allows her to really enjoy the experience more than just a bunch of technical technique. And maybe a wife is okay with a 7-minute experience just for her husband's sake. And we shouldn't allow the high priestesses of feminism to tell us, no, you deserve more! Because maybe that's all that she wants and she's okay with that. And let's not let, again, the high priestesses of feminism tell us what we should be doing in our bedrooms. Sex is, in many cases, is an act of selfless love. And that's going to go both ways sometimes. This is a great place for us to look at 1 Corinthians 7. And really just look at what it says. 1 Corinthians 7. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 3. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights. It's a polite way of saying he should fulfill his sexual obligations to her, and likewise the wife to her husband. Does this passage say that a husband and a wife are going to do this in exactly the same proportion with one another? It does not say that. A wife may find that she doesn't require intimacy at a physical level as often as her husband does. And actually, see, this is a bit of a problem is with the wisdom of the world is, you know, you've got Kinsey and Masters and Johnson and the rise of sex therapy, and then Christian authors pick it up, and you've got Tim LaHaye writing The Act of Marriage, and you've got Intended for Pleasure, which was one of the first big Christian sex books, and you've got these Christian sex books that are kind of bringing in this new understanding of sex therapy and telling a husband how to please his wife. But with that comes the idea that the only sex that counts as good sex is a mutually fulfilling experience where both couples are physically satisfied. And again, that's, I think, where we get into situations where a wife's saying, not tonight, honey, because I'm way too tired for that. And we got to go back to just what the Bible says. And maybe there's times where it's okay for a wife to fulfill her conjugal rights to her husband. And she doesn't need him in that moment to fulfill his conjugal rights to her. And those of you who are married, I'm not going to elaborate more than this, but I think you can pick up what I'm putting down. And that's okay. For a couple to love one another and to know that sometimes that's not going to be fully a reciprocal thing all the time. Now, I'm not giving excuses here for husbands to not love their wives. I'm just acknowledging the fact that our bodies work differently. Couples are often at different places. Sex is going to look different for different people at different times. And that's okay. As a physical experience, sex is sometimes going to be like a snack, sometimes like a sit-down meal, sometimes like a five-star, three-course meal. And you have to know wisely how to balance all those experiences in a healthy marriage.
Maybe we're going to talk about this later, but would you say that that's one reason why it's super important to talk about sex in a marriage? Because it'd be easier for the man than for the woman to assume the lack of desire on his wife's part. And if they're talking about it, like if I'm indebted to my wife to fulfill her rights in that way, we have to talk about it. So I know what she would desire from me, right? And so,
which is one of the most unsexy aspects of married sex. That couples kind of got, Jordan, you're I'm glad that you're bringing this up, and I assume that people would
maybe if Thursday's the night, you talk about it Wednesday, but
well, I'm assuming, when I talked about it's not spontaneous all the time, this is what I'm getting at. And you're making it clear, and I'm glad you're making it clear, because we need to make this clear. If it's not spontaneous, it's got to be planned, which means you're going to have to talk about it. And you're going to have to talk about more than that. You're going to have to talk about what is a healthy pattern of sexual intimacy and relationship look like in our marriage. It's going to look different at different seasons, at different stages of health, for example, and so on. And that's going to require lots of ongoing communication. There's no doubt about that. Ladies, married women, don't make your husband beg. That is something that can often come up, and I think it comes from this very feminist assumption about what sex needs to look like all the time. That if you're not up for it, well then, I don't know. 1 Corinthians 7 points to the fact that if a couple's not having sex regularly, that Satan may tempt them because of their lack of self-control. We often assume that temptation to sex is a single man's business, and then when he gets married, it kind of goes away. There is a sense, and I was so grateful that I was in a small group with all married men. I was actually leading a small group with a bunch of married men when I was engaged to Amy. I don't know who let that happen. But those men prepared me for the fact that, Chris, you're not going to get married and have your sexual temptation go away. In fact, there's a sense in which getting married actually increases your capacity to be tempted. And it wasn't just these guys. It was another couple of married guys who were telling me the same thing and preparing me for that. Marriage introduces new capacities for temptation that are not there as single men, which is all the more important why wives stay communicating with their husbands and husbands with their wives to understand how their sex life can best serve as a protection against Satan's temptations, which is another one of the functions. And you might think, well, before he was married, we weren't having sex at all, and so now, you know, once whatever you think is a reasonable pattern, that's more than he was getting, you don't realize that that once every pattern has turned up some knobs in his body in terms of the dial control center of his brain, and it has really increased his capacity for temptation, and so that becomes really important. Josh, you were going to say something?
So with this selfless, you know, cellmate, as Piper called it, and what about this hypothesis, and I promise it's a hypothesis, I'm not just referring to the person, but take a husband with a super high sex drive, and this is something an older man, my life talk, Christian older man talked to me about, but say a husband has a high sex drive and says, babe, I need 2 or 3 nights, even after the first night that they come together. And then the second night says, hey, it increased, right? And this is why I'm bringing this up. It increased, and so the next night, I just need more of that. And then the third night, I just need some more of that. Is that an unrealistic, insatiable appetite that doesn't necessarily need to be fulfilled? So that's the first question. And then for the wife, is it okay for her to say, that's a self-discipline issue. I don't need to give you myself 2 or 3 times out of 3 nights. Who's right or wrong?
Both. And it depends. You probably didn't want to hear me give such an unsatisfying answer, but I think this becomes an area of where a couple needs to grow in their self-understanding and in their communication with one another. There may be seasons where that amount of frequency is not inappropriate. And there also may be times where a guy just needs to know, like, dude, you need to, I mean, this is why practicing self-control before you're married is so important, because it's not like when you're married, you suddenly get to not have self-control anymore, right? Like, a married man's going to need self-control. And, I mean, Paul assumes here that there are temporary times of coming apart. So the assumption is a man's able to do that temporarily. And so I think there are the situation you described is a great situation for that couple to engage in communication with one another and maybe to get someone else in on it, to say, is this wrong or is this normal? How long is this going on for? Is this a particular season where there's a particular need, or is this a problem that we kind of need to fix? Like, look, a guy needs to know the difference between I would enjoy being intimate with my wife right now and this is more of something that we should do right now. Because especially younger men in their 20s, if they had the option, it would be, you know, every 2 hours, and that's just not realistic. And so did I answer your question? Okay. Jordan.
I don't want to drag this out, sorry, but I read an article, I don't know, this year sometime, so not too long ago, and hopefully this is a different statistic within the church, I think it was just general, but men are tending way more sexually apathetic than women more and more, and that's probably because of porn and just immediately accessible outlets with low commitment and things like that, but, like, do you have anything to say about that, how that problem that might... that problem of wives making their husbands beg, that might be an indication of some health, how that's kind of flipping now? And
that's a good point. Like, if he's coming to her, now what I'm not saying is I'm not trying to justify the selfish husband who's being sinfully demanding of his wife. But yeah, that is healthy. See, everyone thought that the increase of pornography, which also became much more mainstream and publicly accessible around the time of the 60s, that was a part of the sexual revolution. that was going to make, like, there was real concern that that was going to turn men into these oversexed sex freaks, and that we were going to see these huge increases in rape and all that kind of stuff. Like, that was the kind of thing people were worried about back in the 60s. And what we've kind of seen statistically is that the opposite has happened. Men are actually, as a whole, thinking about, like, young, let's say college men, less interested, less sexually active than they were, because this is how one article put it, one news article put it, and this is a really offensive statement, but this sums up the sentiment of a lot of young men, is that a real naked woman is just bad porn. That's an awful thing to say, but that's the reality that a lot of young men find themselves in. They've been so slaughtered by pornography that a real woman is just not as interested, or not as interesting to them. Sexual apathy is a part of it. Also, I think with that comes the way in, or another reason for that, if I could venture hazard a guess, is the way in which men have been neutered by feminism. We're kind of taught that, like, it's not good to be a man, that any just kind of, like, I really want to be with my wife right now is not a good thing. And sort of the tropes have worked our way into culture that it's like, well, not tonight, honey, I have a headache. And that's just what you expect to hear again and again and again. And so guys learn to be ashamed of their sexuality, ashamed of their sex drive, ashamed of the fact that God made them with a built-in drive to want to express their covenant union with their wife. And over time, if he gets his wrist slapped too many times, and if he knows that his wife is going to just keep on belittling him again and again and again, he's going to feel like a little boy begging for more again and again and again. He's just going to stop. Like, if every time that a guy initiates with his wife, it ends up just becoming belittling and embarrassing and disappointing for him, he's going to stop approaching his wife. He's just going to turn, that part of him is just going to be turned off more and more and more. And so, yeah, wives need to know how dangerous this world is for men, and how important of a role they play in helping protect them from temptation, how good and glorious of a thing it is for men to be seeking intimacy, physical intimacy, with the woman that he's covenantally united to.
Right. And I agree with all of that. What I'm saying on top of that is that there's an exhortation there for women not to make their husbands beg or anything like that, and an exhortation for men to not become sexually apathetic in such a disgusting world, to kind of make sure your wife can assume that if you would kind of be knocking on anybody's door,
it's hers. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That you want her.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good for that to be the case. No, that's very good, Jordan. It's often assumed and talked about the fact that for women, emotional intimacy is as important as anything else. That, in my experience, and just from what I have learned and known, that's actually true of men quite a bit more. For when a man feels respected by his wife, feels treasured, and that she rejoices in his strength and loves the fact that he's hers, when he knows that she's proud of him, when she praises him, like, all of that is as much of a, I don't want to use a crude phrase like turn on, but I want to say, like, that is as sexually empowering to a man as anything else, if not more than anything else. That which goes back to our understanding here that sex is a reenactment of your covenantal union. So the more healthy your covenantal union is, the more that you're rejoicing in each other and praising each other and delighting and caring for each other, the better sex is going to be. And the things that make for a good marriage make for good sex, because sex is a reenactment of the marital union at a physical level. So it shouldn't surprise us that it works that way.
Which gets into sex starting outside of the bedroom.
That is absolutely huge, is that physical act is a consummation of the entire relationship and how good it, so the better that sex is, the better that your marriage is, the better sex will be. And a husband can't think that he can just be a slob and hop into bed and his wife's going to be right where he wants her to be. Sex is the cherry on top of the cake of marriage. And the better that cake is, the Well, okay, that metaphor kind of breaks down. But anyways, it's a magical cherry that the more icing you put on the cake, the bigger and juicier and larger that cherry gets. Okay, forget that. Here's what I found being married for 13 years, huh? Is it 14 yet? I keep jumping ahead. 13 years. That the more that I reject the wisdom of the world, and the more that I remember what sex fundamentally is, a reenactment of covenant union, the greater my joy is. And the more that I embrace the wisdom of the world, subtly let it influence me, the lesser my joy is. I don't think we should be surprised by that. There's so much more we could say, which is why lots of good books have been written about sex by Christians. And I would point you, like, some of the Christian marriage books that we've talked about in this at the beginning of this series here, they're going to have great sections on sex. There is some one of the books that I recommend for couples who are not yet married, or just for couples who are married, is the book One Flesh Marriage. I forget the authors, but it's a Matthias book. It's out of print, but you can get the ebook. It's a really helpful book that, you know, you shouldn't read till you're going to get married. And even then, not, you know, you don't want to be reading it too far ahead because it might not be helpful, but that's a great book to take with you on a honeymoon. And there's a lot to learn about sex. Tonight, we have primarily focused on big picture things because I think way too often Christians jump into the specifics assuming the world story. So tonight's been about telling the new story, and there's a lot of specifics to be fleshed out there. Very, very quickly here, there is a beautiful connection between children and sex. That's God's design. I do not believe it's sinful for Christians to practice birth control out of principle if they're doing it for wise covenant reasons. We're in the new covenant. We don't have a command to be fruitful and multiply like they did in the Abrahamic Israelite covenants. And so I believe that because we have the knowledge that we have, it can be appropriate for couples to practice wisdom about how many children and when they have children. I think it's really important for them to do that for reasons that are God-honoring and kingdom-oriented and not just selfish. But we need to be careful about what type of birth control we use. The pill has all kinds of really terrible reasons why a lot of women avoid it, how it just does a number on their body. There's the possibility of it causing abortions of fetuses. There's some reasons against that. When I do pre-marriage counseling, I promote that couples get familiar at least with the fertility awareness method. It's super popular in Europe. It's popular among Catholics very often here. Basically, there are a couple of physical signs, one of which is basal body temperature. So if a woman wakes up and takes her temperature first thing every morning, there's a spike in the temperature that happens around the time of ovulation, and a woman is able to know when she is or isn't fertile. And combined with barrier methods, this can be a very effective way of a couple timing when they are going to seek to have children and when they're going to seek to prevent children. It's not foolproof, and I'm not a doctor, so do your homework on this. I can say that for Amy and I, it was an effective way for us to plan our family, which we did, hopefully, as best as we could for God-honoring, kingdom-oriented reasons. Unmarried couples also need to be prepared for the reality of miscarriage, for the reality of infertility. I'm saying this for the benefit of people who are using this video for in pre-marriage counseling contexts. You need to talk about what if we can't have kids? What are we going to do? What does fostering look like or adoption look like? Or do we invest our lives as just a couple who doesn't have kids and invest our lives in other people in that way? How will we respond to miscarriage, which is a reality that many couples experience? And then couples also, before they're married, need to talk about what will they do if they do have kids? And questions like how will we discipline them? How will we raise them? How will we school them? the way that things are progressing in our society and in our public school system, parents who sent their kids to public school, you know, 20 years ago are now saying, there's no way I would send my kid to public school if I was starting all over right now. I've said this to many young unmarried couples, if you're not willing to homeschool, you shouldn't have kids. And what I'm not saying there is you have to homeschool, but what if you find yourself in a situation where you do have to, as more and more couples do find themselves in that spot, because stuff that is being taught to their kids is so just awful and anti-biblical worldview at so many levels, and it's starting younger and younger and younger, that they need to, and yet if a couple has had kids just assuming that they can just send them to public school and there's no Christian school options, what are they going to do? So I think a couple needs to consider that whether they can homeschool before they even have kids. And that sounds extreme. Actually, probably did sound extreme 10 years ago. It doesn't sound extreme in 2025. Kids are a blessing. One of the reasons they're a blessing is that they're stinking hard, and they kick the selfishness out of you with their tiny little feet again and again and again and again. Having kids is way harder than anyone ever thinks. That's one of the reasons that they're a blessing. Don't reject that blessing, but also don't assume that having kids is everything and the whole goal of your life. And we've talked about that more in other contexts. And that is the end, not of all that we could say, but of all that I have prepared to say. Thank you for your patience, for hanging on for this wild ride. Let's pray. God, thank you for sex. It's your idea, it's your invention, it's your creation, it's your gift. It is not something that we need to be whole and complete. We think of our Lord Jesus, we think of men like the Apostle Paul and Timothy. We know that sex is not a requirement to being a whole person. Thank you that we don't need it. When a couple is married, we thank you that you've given this gift to reenact and experience afresh their covenant union and the grace of that covenant and the joy of that covenant. For the people that are here and who are listening to this who are married, Lord, would you help them to cherish and love each other sexually, to communicate well, to reject the wisdom of the world, to embrace the joy that comes from understanding themselves in your story and not the world's story. God, for the people who are not married, would you help them to work really hard now by the help of your Spirit to reject the world's story, to embrace your story, to identify the lies that they're told every single day in our media-soaked culture, and to reject those and to embrace your good story, to fight temptation, to fight for purity by the power of your Spirit. I pray that for every person, married or not, you know the specific temptations for both married and unmarried people. And would you help us, Lord, to be people who fight for purity, who fight for covenant faithfulness by the power of your Spirit for the glory of your name. And we thank you, Lord, that as good as sex is, what is coming in the full and glorious experience of intimacy with you forever in heaven will make it seem like the shadow that it was. So we can't wait, Lord. Give our hearts greater anticipation and joy in that than in anything else. And I pray this, Jesus, in your name.